We're going to be looking at Exodus 26, but we're also going to be spending a bit of time in chapters 27 and 30, both this week and next week. So keep them open, have 26 open in front of you as we go this morning. What does your home say about you? Years ago, there was a TV show called Through the Keyhole. Do you remember it? Lloyd Grossman would host and he would take you around a celebrity's home, and the contestants in the studio would then have to try and guess from what they saw whose home it was. So Lloyd would point to some pictures or particular ornaments in the home, or he'd look out at the gardens or particular displays within the house, and then he would ask in that distinctive voice, you know, whose home is this? Bad impression, I know, but... And then you have to guess. What would your home say about you? What would it reveal? That you're an avid reader, gamer, cook, TV watcher, dog lover, family mad, board game enthusiast, neat person, cluttered person, hoarder, minimalist, big family, little family, skier, footballer. But what does it say about you? And as you heard Exodus 26 read, you might have just thought, weird. Some of you did, didn't you? You know, what can we learn about curtains and tents and frames and sparse furnishings? Well, a home tells you a lot. And over this week and next, we're going to be thinking about God's home, what it reveals of Him. Last week, we were thinking about how God's eternal purpose is that we dwell with Him. This week, we begin to see He dwells with us now. But what does that mean? I mean, it sounds nice, but what does that look like for us in our everyday Christian life? Well, let's spend some time just thinking about God tabernacling with the Israelites. And the word tabernacle literally means dwelling place or living place. And as we saw last week, Moses was told to construct this tent on the patterns given to him by the Lord. It was based on the heavenly tabernacle dwelling place. And the tabernacle is the first home in which God gives us so much detail about His home. And it was built for hospitality. It screamed, I'm here, I'm with you, I'm amongst you. But the tabernacle is not the first time that we see God dwelling with His people. Eden was God's home back in Genesis 1 and 2. It was all about life and communion. Mount Sinai was God's home, Exodus 24. It was about sacrifice and meals and communion and promises made to His people and directions for how to be His people. And now we have this portable tent or tabernacle becoming His home. His people were living in tents. God was going to join them. And the floor plans of God's home are similar, not surprising, as they're all based on a heavenly template. So we see in Eden, if you've got a handout, it's on the back for you as well. In Eden, you had the inner garden itself, where the tree of life was and the tree of knowledge and good and evil, the kind of the garden mist where God dwelt with His people, equivalent to the most holy place where He walked with Adam and Eve. You then have the rest of the garden, which functions as the holy place. You then had Eden, the land where the garden was, the kind of outer courtyard. Then outside of that, you had the unoccupied, untamed land, where Adam and Eve end up after Genesis 3. And in time, man will go further, and as Cain sins, he goes into the land of Nod, further east. After the fall, you had the cherubim guarding the most holy place and the garden not allowing entry. You come to the mountain, you see a similar pattern. Only Moses goes all the way up into the most holy place to meet with God. You then have the 70 elders who eat with God in the holy place. You then have the Israelites at the bottom, as it were, in the courtyard, and beyond you have the nations. So when it comes to the tabernacle, you see exactly the same pattern. God's home consisted of a tent. It was surrounded by a courtyard, which was surrounded by the people of Israel. And beyond them was the world that needed the God of Israel. In the tent was God's inner chamber, the most holy place. It was located furthest from the entrance, and the rest of his house, as it were, supported this particular room. The most holy place connected to an adjacent apartment called the Holy Place. It was kind of a receiving room. It was maintained regularly by assigned priests. In the surrounding courtyard, the priests performed their duties, presented sacrifices, and here the people could come. Each area, though minimalist, contained key details. They said something about who this God was. On one hand, it screamed, "Beauty, glory, come be with me." Yet at the same time, it screamed, and we'll see this next week, "Holy, danger, come only as directed." But what have it looked like? What have it felt like? Well, imagine a priest coming to work and he's entering the tabernacle. As he approaches the tabernacle, what he would see was a 7-foot surrounding wall of fine white linen. Went all the way around the courtyard. We learn that in chapter 27, verse 9. The posts that held the curtains had silver bands and bronze bases and bronze pegs. The entrance curtain was distinct, chapter 27, verse 16. It had multicolored stitching. It was blue. It was purple. It was scarlet. It was the work of an embroiderer. It was suitable for a king's tent. The entrance was on the east side, always east. Why? Because when Adam and Eve were banished from the garden, they went east. In the Bible, to go east is to go away from God. Now the tabernacle, established with an east-facing entrance, so that those who had gone away could come back from the east. You walk westward towards God. God's home, his entrance shouts, "Come, be with me, you're welcome, I want you." Then the priest entered the outer courtyard. The sky itself here was the ceiling. It was decidedly earthly. There was no special floor. There was no gold. The first thing you saw was a bronze altar on which sacrifices were continually offered. It's clear you're welcome, but the way into the tabernacle necessitated passing the altar, from which blood and death just filled the senses. The problem was clear. People needed to be forgiven and cleansed before entering into God's house. The solution was clear. God would accept a substitute or a representative in your place. For now, that was an animal, which of course ultimately pointed to a greater sacrifice, the Lord Jesus himself. For now, though, God accepted animals. You're welcome. Come in. Further in still, the priest would then walk past the altar, and still in the outer courtyard was a bronze lava, a basin. The water was for cleaning. So chapter 30, 17 to 21, it was made of mirrors, it reflected the blue sky, the heavens, and it prepared the priest for work. Within the holy place, you would wash before touching holy things. Once cleansed, they could go into the actual home. It was enclosed, as chapter 26 describes, with 4 layers of curtains, which rested on frames made of acacia wood. So chapter 26, verse 15 to 29, we learn they're expensive. They're layered with gold and gold rings to hold the wood. And if you notice, it progresses in richness of metal. So outside in the courtyard, bronze, silver. Now you're inside God's home. It's gold. It's expensive. This is the home of a king. And what the priest would see as he looked around the holy place were these curtains, verses 1 to 6, that were just beautiful. Blue and purple and scarlet in color, with cherubim woven into the entrance, evoking Eden and the angelic guards at the entrance. And it's possible that the colors, the blue represented the heavens where God dwelt, the purple kingly, the scarlet blood, the need of atonement. But it would have been clear as a priest as you stepped in there that you were in the king's home. Not only the priests were allowed in there, but the Israelites who were allowed into the courtyard might just catch a glimpse inside the home that God was amongst them as they saw the entrance. But they knew God was dwelling with them. This inner layer of curtains was then a layer of curtains made of goat hair or goat skins, verses 7 to 12. Probably representing the covering God provided to cover the shame of Adam and Eve back in Genesis 3. Do you remember how he gave them skins to cover their sin? Here now is covering. Over that were ram skins dyed red to represent the sacrifices and blood required to provide a covering for sin. And then lastly, we learn verse 14, there was a covering made of durable leather. We're not quite told of what it exactly is. There's some thought that it's made of a kind of large aquatic mammal's skin hide. But it provided waterproofing, protection from the elements. But it all screamed, this is God. He's dwelling. As that priest entered, they were moving from the earthly outside courtyard into the heavenly, where everything was gold, where everything said and spoke of the presence of God. In the holy place, there were just three bits of furniture. There was the light that came from the golden lampstand that was decorated as a living tree, 25:31. It echoed the light of the first day of creation, of God's presence into the world. It shouted, as we saw last week, God is at home. I'm here. But it was also joined to the tree of life. It was shaped as a tree, remembering the tree in the garden. Light equals life. The God who was present brought life to those who he dwelt with. Light and life in contrast to darkness and death. The lampstand had seven lamps. The light of these lamps pointed forward to a gold-covered table that had 12 loaves on it, symbolizing God's care, his provision for all 12 family groups within Israel. In other words, God's people were in the holy place. God's dwelling had always been intended for his people, and his light shines on them. He was with them. He was bringing life. He was bringing light, direction. He was bringing provision. He was bringing himself. Here it was, symbolically expressed. The last piece of furniture was the altar of incense. We learn about that in chapter 30, verses 1 to 10. It's closest to the next curtain that separates the holy place from the most holy place. Like everything else in the tabernacle, it was crammed with meaning and revealed an extravagant host. It was in effect, he'd brought the beauty of himself and his home, even to humanity's sense of smell, was present now. They couldn't see his presence, but you could, as it were, smell his presence. You knew, you know how some homes have distinctive smells? You kind of know, oh yeah, that's so-and-so's home. You walk in immediately, you know. There's that sense here. You walk in, this is God's home. Sense of his presence. Here was the beauty of it. That incense would have mingled with the burning sacrifices 50 feet away out in the courtyard that then sent smoke into the heavens. The altar smoke became a sweet and pleasing aroma to the Lord. The smoke represented the prayer of the Israelites for forgiveness and fellowship, and they were sweet and acceptable to the Lord. He delighted to be with his people. He heard the prayers of his people. It was pleasing to him. He was dwelling with them and hearing them and being with them. It all screamed, I'm here. Then furthest into the tabernacle was the most holy place, which the Lord gave access to once a year to only the high priest. In it was the throne of God, the golden box, the ark. It contained the manna and a copy of the Ten Commandments. It spoke of his kingly rule, his provision, his personal speech. Above the box stood two angels, the cherubim, where sacrifice was made once a year before the very throne of God, and mercy was given. Extended to God and to his people, enabling them to dwell with him and he, their king, with them. See, here in the tabernacle is where God would meet with his people. And so we read chapter 29, 42, there I meet with you and speak with you. Here he would dwell. Everything in the tabernacle spoke of his presence, of its beauty, of its wealth, of reflecting the heavens on earth. The tabernacle declared God's home is open for life and guidance, for provision, the table for fellowship, hearing and responding to his people, for mercy, the ark, his kingly rule over his people. The living God was dwelling amongst his people. As they lived in tents, so would he. And as an Israelite with your tent pitched around the tabernacle, what would you think? God's with us. He's dwelling amongst us. Now, of course, God's not contained to a tent. His glory was present. It symbolized his presence. And yet he was truly with them. So what now would they have to fear? Enemies? God was with them. What would they possibly lack? Food, water? Well, God was with them. How would they know how to get to the promised land? Well, God was with them. Would God hear their cries for help, for need, for mercy? Yep, God was with them. What happened when they sinned? Well, there would be forgiveness. He provided a means. God was with them. He tabernacled with them. His tent proclaimed it. It's all its imagery. But it all pointed to an even greater dwelling, to an even greater time, where God would truly be with his people, and all because he would enter his world, not in a tent, but in a man. See, Jesus now tabernacles as a man with us. See, the tabernacle pointed to that far greater reality of dwelling fulfilled in Jesus. So John records, John 1:14, that the Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us, or literally pitched his tent among us. God did not just symbolically then dwell in a tent. He now literally, in reality, Jesus, the Word, tabernacled with us. And all the furnishings and their symbolism in the tent that screamed, God is with us, is fulfilled in Christ. So we discover that Jesus is the true ark. He is the person. He is the place through whom mercy is extended and flows. Because he is the place of the sacrifice, as the ark was. But he is also not just the place of the sacrifice. He is the sacrifice. As he died on a cross, as he bore our sin, as he was our representative, as he takes God's judgment for our sin, he then pours forth mercy to all who believe and trust in him, calling us to live under his merciful rule, to dwell with him. And he contains all the words of God. He's the very king the ark pointed to, and whose mercy draws us into his kingdom to live under his rule and dwells with him as our king. And he's not a box. He's a person in the flesh before us. And Jesus is the true bread. John 6:35 says, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry. And he is the very bread of life, provides all we need, his perfect care for his people. He gives us life. He brings us into the presence of God. He sustains us with his grace and strength as we feed on him daily, as he dwells with us by his Spirit, Romans 8, as we come to him. And as we remember shortly, as we'll feed on this loaf, we remember that we feed on him. He sustains. He's with us. And then we learn Jesus is the true lamp, John 8:12. He's the light of God in whom we walk. He said, I'm the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. He brings God's light to bear. He guides. He leads. He brings life as it ought to be. Light in darkness. Life instead of death. He brings light as he dwells with us. Jesus is the altar of the incense. He now takes our prayers into the very throne room of God. He hears. He delights to hear. He sees now the realities of God dwelling and come and personal and real with us. But are you saying, that's all very well. But Jesus doesn't dwell with us. He's not present. I can't see him. And yet here's the remarkable thing, isn't it? That the one who came and tabernacled amongst us now tabernacles within us by his Spirit. Such that Paul can write 2 Corinthians 6:19 that we're the very temple of God, the very tabernacle. No longer does God reside in a tent, he resides in us by his Spirit, Romans 8. As we come to Jesus by faith, as we look to him to cleanse us and to pay the punishment and to draw us into his presence by dwelling within us by his Spirit, until that day we see him face to face. Have you ever stopped to think that the living God dwells within you? I mean, the Israelites woke up each day and looked out of their tent and saw God's tent, and they knew that God was with them. But we wake as believers each day and know he is within us by his Spirit and has given us his word and enabled us to speak with him through prayer. Have you ever stopped to think what an awesome thing that is, that the God of the universe literally dwells, tabernacles within you, if you are trusting in Christ? And as he tabernacles within you, he brings you light and life and fellowship and mercy, all under his personal kingly rule. I mean, the whole picture of the tabernacle is that of God drawing near to his people, and the comfort and the assurance that that brings. And now we discover he's drawn near, so near that he's within. And when I grasp that, that changes things. More specifically, it changes me. Let me show you how. I've mentioned before that probably the prevailing sin pattern in my life is fearing what others think. The fear of man. So even at the age of 44, I'll still feel guilty. It will chew me up if I say no to my wider family. Even if I know it's the right thing to do, I've sought advice, I've prayed over it, because I'll worry about what they'll think of me, of my witness before them. And it causes tensions within me, within my immediate family. You can see how that might work. Or if it's not saying no to them, maybe it's saying no to others closer, worrying, and then what they'll think less of me, or they'll think I'm lazy, or what I'll end up doing is doing something. I'll say yes instead of when I should have said no, and I do something that I really shouldn't have done, or in terms of not sinful or wrong, but just time-wise, when I should have been spending time with family or being with my immediate family. And again, you can imagine the tensions, the stress that can cause. So here I am now, anxious, and I'm fearful, and I'm worried. Worried about what you're thinking of me. But hold on, God says he's near to me. God says his Spirit dwells within me. What does that look like now? In this scenario, as I battle with this particular sin and these circumstances. I was reading Hebrews 13:5-6. Hebrews 13:5-6 says, "Never will I leave you, never will I forsake you." So we say with confidence, "The Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What can mere mortals do to me?" Never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. That sounds like him dwelling with me and in me, doesn't it? Why is that promise in Hebrews 13 true? Because Jesus' Spirit dwells within me. He tabernacles in me. Now, if I start living in light of that promise, of that assurance, what will happen? The bread of life is with me. I lack nothing. He will provide all I need. He will give me the courage to say no. He will allow me to speak into the situation with wisdom and grace, not run from it. He'll give me peace when I feel guilty. He'll quieten my soul. He is the bread of life. He'll give me what I need. He dwells within me. And when I say no, and maybe I'll get some flack back, and I'll begin to feel guilty and alone and an outsider to my family, my wider family, where will be the comfort? I'm with you. I'll never leave you. I'll never forsake you. What can they do to you? They can say a few things, but I'm with you. He's walking with me. I'm not alone. The light of the world who brings light and life to the situation. He'll give clarity where there's darkness, understanding where there is none. I have all I need. He's drawn near. Friends, this is where the truth of the tabernacle, as it were, cashes out in our everyday life. It's not just out there. It's not just some kind of nice idea, some nice bit of theology, some nice kind of fancy bits of furniture. This is where it cashes out. Not to make me feel nice and fuzzy and have a warm feeling. It's the reality as I battle with sin. As you endure the trials of life. The everyday. As you're faced with that decision to speak out at work. He says, I'm with you. I'll help you. I'll give you courage. I'll strengthen you. As you worry about finances. He says, I am the bread of life. I'll provide and care for you. Trust me. I hear your prayers. Remember the altar of incense? I'm with you. I won't forsake you. And yet so often, we seek to live as if that was not the case. The Israelites. It's remarkable, isn't it? They start to grumble. They have no food. Why? Because they forgot that the bread of life was with them. They become fearful when enemies attacked. Why? Because they forgot that the ark, the king, was ruling and was with them. And we struggle with sin, or we become anxious, or we become fearful because we forget who is with us and in us, bringing light and guidance and mercy and help and provision. Or you start to doubt and you forget who is within us. The one who rules, the one who saved us, the one who holds all things in his hands, including us. Or you start to worry, you do not have enough and you forget who is within you, the bread of life. Do you see how this just keeps going? You know when you're a kid and it's dark and you have to walk through a kind of dark, half-lit park, like Victoria Park, early morning or late evening. And you're on your own. Maybe you've got to get through the park to get to school. And it feels scary. Alone, you're nervous, you're anxious. You don't want to go there. But as you stand there, what happens next is your dad draws alongside and he puts his hand in yours. And what happens? Your fears go. Your worries subside. Dad's there. Similar, but greater. The Lord dwells amongst you, within you. All that was symbolized in that tabernacle is now fulfilled in Jesus, and he dwells in you by his Spirit, giving you light and life and provision and mercy and his rule and his words to govern and guide you. Never will he leave you. Never will he forsake you. What could you possibly lack in this life? What could you possibly fear? What doubts remain? What sin cannot be overcome? What struggles can you not bear? What call to service can you not do? What enemies can defeat you? What can separate you from the love of God when you remember the Lord tabernacles within you, giving you a foretaste of what will be for all eternity, drawing you to himself. His hand in yours, in the very midst of your life. He's not on the outside. He's in the middle. He's personal. He's real. He's bringing light and mercy and grace and guidance and fellowship right here, right now. Do you believe that? Have you grasped that? Have you seen the wonder of that?